It's The Blue of the Night with Eamon Lenihan and a special guest who may well be unlocking one or two secrets of the universe. You're very welcome, Lawrence Hopgood.
Thank you, Eamon.
How are you? What brings you to this neck of the woods, Lawrence?
Well, I'm happy to say that my good friend Paddy Cannan has been talking about having me pay a visit for some time. And when I saw him in Dublin earlier this year, I said, Paddy, I'm trying to do some more playing on my own, and I'm going to be making a Christmas record. And what would you think about trying to arrange for some solo piano-ish engagements where I might wend through some of the Christmas material? And he thought that was a grand idea, and so he started making some calls, and it all just sort of happened.
Which parts of the country did you visit?
Been to Killarney, Waterville, and staying in Tralee, and I'm here in Limerick.
But you are busy doing many other things. Can you tell us about some of the ongoing projects?
Well, I'm very, very pleased to say that a few years ago, coming out of Kurt's project, which was the record that finally won a Grammy, the Dedicated to You project, developed a very strong friendship with Ernie Watts, the great saxophonist. And a couple of years ago, I worked up the nerve to ask him to play in my band, and he surprised me by saying yes. We did a quartet tour about a year and a half ago, and I've written for sextet, and I've obviously written for trio, and never in quintet format. So I did that, adding a trumpet, and we toured last month very successfully, and I loved the way that it went, and Ernie loved it, and so that's looking like that might turn into a real going concern.
Who was in the band, Lawrence?
The bassist is Clark Summers. Mm. The drummer is named Jared Schoenig. Very interesting young guy. Parents teach at an arts high school in L.A., and he plays piano similar to, you know, how Jack DeJohnette is a fairly accomplished pianist. Very musical drummer, and Jared's like that. Ernie on saxophone, of course, and then a young trumpet player from Chicago named Marquise Hill, 26 years old. And, man, he stepped up to this material and really blew the doors off of it. And we had a great time touring around the Midwest, and I'm real proud of it. So hopefully that's going to be making the rounds.
And where do you come across these young fellas?
I know Clark from playing with Kurt. Jared was recommended to me in New York several years ago, and we started playing together. Any gigs that I did there whenever he was available, which fortunately for me was most of the time. And then Marquise actually came up because a New York-based trumpet player had to drop out of the tour, and I was wondering about who to get, and Clark first and then a few other people told me about this young guy from Chicago who was really making a sound there, so I enlisted him, and boy, did I not regret it. He's just amazing.
Yeah, how long are you doing this now, Lawrence? How many years?
Classically trained from a very young age, but I started jazz when I was 15, and I'm now 53, so 2 years shy of 40 years that I've been playing.
Are you from a musical family then?
Well, I'm from an arts family, and my parents were both amateur musicians. My dad was a theater teacher, great director and teacher of theater arts. And my mom was an Appalachian folk artist who specialized in dancing and literature.
Classically trained from an early age. How early?
Started lessons when I was 5 and a half, I think.
This was where?
Dallas, Texas. Piano prep at SMU.
SMU?
Southern Methodist University,
Your father was employed there.
He was the director of the theater program at that time. I started lessons not that long after we moved there in the mid-60s.
So when did the interest in jazz develop?
We moved to Illinois. He accepted the directorship of the theater program at University of Illinois. I was 15, so as you would guess, I discontinued my lessons in Dallas a month before we moved. And we moved to Illinois, and it can be kind of a traumatic time to pull up stakes and move 5 states away or whatever. And so we'd been in Urbana, Illinois for several months, and I just wasn't playing the piano at all. And my father was very disturbed by this in his own quiet way, because he was convinced that that was my talent, music. And he had thought I was going to be a concert pianist, and I think he finally had to just say to himself, I just don't think the kid's a classical career guy. He seems to have this improvisational ability since he was a little kid. He's been making things up and learning tunes by ear off the radio and whatnot, maybe jazz. And there was a young professor on the piano pedagogy faculty at that time who played jazz, and I got lessons with him, and it just went from there.
But you hadn't listened to any jazz music?
Actually, my parents used to play Dave Brubeck, right. And one of the incredible, beautiful turns of fate was I ended up becoming friends with Dave years later.
Yeah.
And also, sort of a funny story, my dad took me to see one of the Duke Ellington Sacred concerts, and he had, of course, officially retired from the incredible schedule he used to keep leading a big band, but the Sacred concerts were sort of his epilogue, and they toured on a much more relaxed schedule, and they were playing at a huge Methodist church in North Dallas, and my dad took me, at his suggestion, I took my parents' copy of Duke Ellington's Greatest Hits, LP, and got Duke to sign it, and I've still got that framed and hanging in my house. But the funny thing, that was my first live jazz experience, and so I can honestly say there's every chance that the greatest jazz concert I will ever hear was the first one that I ever heard.
This was, what, the late 60s, was it?
1971, yeah.
And it was the full, what, 17-piece
Ellington
Orchestra?
It was an expanded big band. The band with a small gospel choir, and then I remember four gospel soloists in front, big ensemble. And it's incredibly precocious to tell, but when I stood online afterwards to get Duke's autograph, I remember he was wearing a few fuchsia tuxedo, string tie, hair with all the pomade, and he has these beautiful women standing around him as he was greeting people in this line, and I was in a little blue suit, and when I got up and shook his hand, I looked at him, and I said, Mr. Ellington, someday I'm going to be a jazz piano player just like you. And he made that throaty little laugh that he used to make, and then he took my record and signed it.
That then sparked a real interest in jazz music. Did you try to listen to stuff?
I did start trying to listen more, but of course, at that age, I was into Chicago and the Doobie Brothers, Girls, and things like that. But my parents continued to listen to jazz.
What preference did your parents have?
Bill Evans. I remember they had Bill Evans records.
Yeah.
They weren't really into Miles or Train or any of the stuff I discovered on my own.
Uh-huh.
They were into, you know, the more what some might describe as pleasantly listenable jazz. And, of course, nothing wrong with that.
In Illinois, you studied jazz. Did that take you down another avenue then of discovery?
It really did. And the main reason for that is that the blessing I've received is a natural, instinctive understanding of theory and structure in music, which of course lends itself to improvising on an instrument like the piano, where you can do so much as opposed to saxophone or trumpet, where you can do a universe of stuff, but you can only play one note at a time, realistically speaking.
Well, unless you're John Coltrane.
Yeah, well, yeah, there are tricks. So as soon as I started getting this information about chord structure and the various layers that make up musical event, it was fascinating to me because I had done a lot by ear, even all the time that I was playing Beethoven and Schubert and Bach and whatnot. And to start having some of the real explanations for these sounds was really fascinating to me. That said, typical 15, 16-year-old, I didn't work nearly as hard as I could have because I was busy trying to, you know, be socially adept in at least some small way. It's tough for artistic kids at that age.
You were trying to be 15.
I was trying to be 15.
Yeah.
I was never very good at it.
We won't hang you for that.
Yeah. Well, I'm better at it now than I was.
I mean, when you compose a piece, do you improvise it or do you sit down with pen and paper?
First of all, I'm a big on-paper guy.
Okay.
The classical upbringing probably helps with that. But in the last couple of years, I really have gravitated back to a lot of ear work before the pencil hits the page. I really like to sit down and completely flesh something out and get the way more than the seed of an idea. And then I'll start writing. I think the reason for that is that what makes really great jazz writing and arranging is the way in which a given piece, a composition or arrangement, as I put it, negotiates the space. You know, because when you're composing, you're sitting by yourself, and you have the advantage of being able to break everything down so that it's not happening in real time, but when it's going to be performed, it has to happen in real time, and you want to be wary about overwriting, about not adequately developing an idea. And so the act of just playing it again and again, and really listening to it, sometimes recording it, listening back to what you've played, that's how things for me develop.
In the studio then, would you more or less go with what's on the paper, or would you use that as a jumping off point?
Mostly by the time you get into the studio, you want to be sure about what you've written. But you don't want to rule anything out. I just finished producing a record for some friends in L.A. I did about half the arrangements on the record, and on those I was also playing. On the other half of the record was material that the singer named Charmaine Clamore, that her band was already playing. And in both instances, there were several times where I was able to say, you know what, it would be really good to just add 8 measures here, because it seems like you need a little space between these two sections, or that kind of thing, and it's nice to be able to just execute that.
Yeah. Would you ever overdub in the studio?
Oh, absolutely.
And you'd cut and paste?
Absolutely. Yeah. Here's my feeling about that. The studio is a space that is designed to do that. And I've always been a big believer in freedom and responsibility. If you've assumed a certain amount of responsibility, then that earns you a certain set of freedoms. Yeah. And if you are a devoted musician who's worked very hard and is more than capable of sitting down and playing worthy music just live, then to me, that ability to do that has, that assuming that responsibility has earned you the freedom to use the tools that you find in the studio. Because if you're spending the kind of money that it costs to be in a good recording studio, you're there to try to make the end result be as sound and perfect as it can be. That's why you're in there. If that's not what you're going to try to do, then you should be making a recording of a live performance anyway.
Yeah. That's an interesting angle. Not every jazz musician would share your sentiments there, I know.
There's guys out there that would publicly eschew overdubbing or fixing things who in private have done plenty of same.
Okay. Yeah, well, Miles was another one who obviously, like the classical musicians, I suppose, they'd take and take and take and then use the best bits of each.
We all deal with something that musical artists, never used to have to deal with, which is that we no longer really get to choose which of our performances get put out there in the world. Half the people in the audience sometimes are taping a performance and then they put it up on YouTube and stuff like that. And the main reason that this can be frustrating for someone, what if I'm playing in a concert and unfortunately this particular evening I'm playing a piano that's not tuned well? I would really prefer that that not go out there into the world, but I don't have a choice about that anymore. I don't even know where it's gonna come from, because I'm not gonna know that it was the guy 10th from the aisle in the 15th row who put it up. You know, if I can be in studio situations where I can have some influence over perfectionist approach, then that's something that I've earned the right to do.
Any particular piano you prefer?
Oh, I'm a Steinway guy.
Yeah. Which Steinway? Any Steinway in particular?
First of all, the thing about Steinways is that because of the way that they're made, they are all a little bit different. It's rare that I play a Steinway that I don't like. But some I like much, much more than others. At home, I have an old 1927 Model O, which is just shy of 6 feet. Good New York apartment piano. But it was rebuilt in, it's a Hamburg Steinway, that was completely rebuilt in Germany about 10 years ago. And for a piano its size, it's got an incredibly beautiful, buttery, warm tone, and it's beautiful to write on because it sounds beautiful, and so when you play it, you hear beautiful things. I love a Steinway D, big 9-foot piano, but the truth of the matter is that for a lot of jazz applications, I think the B, the 7-foot is more the sound, and beyond that, it just kind of depends on
the player as well, of course. Who would you consider your greatest mentors?
Mentors? I can tell you, my three greatest mentors were a Sicilian avant-garde composer named Salvatore Martirano, who was on the composition faculty at University of Illinois for many, many years, a classical pianist at Illinois, who I believe is nearing retirement now, named Ian Hobson, and he's a British fellow. And the amazing thing about him was that he made me realize that all of my previous teachers, no matter how well-intentioned, had been teaching me how to play pieces. And Ian taught me how to play the piano, a true sort of scientific adaptable, flexible, but a system for training the hands and the arms to do the right thing. And then my third real mentor was the curmudgeonly wizard named John Garvey, who was the director for many years of the University of Illinois Jazz Bands. John himself was a classical violist. He never actually played jazz. And his brother, and I can't remember his first name, but he was Leontine Price's accompanist for many, many years. And John was just an amazing kind of an Obi-Wan Kenobi of musical interpretation and of seeing both the forest and the trees, thinking about shapes of phrases and thinking about making the music tell a story as opposed to just being a bunch of notes flying around. And I got to play in his band for 3 years, and it was one of the most profound learning experiences I ever had.
When did you first meet Kurt Elling?
Met Kurt in 1993. First time we met was at a hotel gig that I was doing, and he knew the musicians I was playing with. And so it turned into one of those awkward social situations, awkward for me and perhaps for him. Mm. He knew them and I knew them. And we had the experience of sitting elbow to elbow, not having been introduced, and still in the conversation that followed, agreeing about much of the sort of absurd things that were being said, agreeing that they were absurd. And I remember us looking at each other and kind of nodding, and I didn't even know who this guy was. About 2 weeks later, I was playing with Ed Peterson at the Green Mill, the Monday night performance, and Ed announced that a young singer was going to sit in with us, which was somewhat flabbergasting. This was a band that played all original material, very difficult, very high challenge, and the best horn players in Chicago would stop by there to quake at Ed's magnificence, but never sat in. So when he said that a singer was going to sit in, I was sitting there at the piano going, really? And then I see this young guy walking up, and I said to myself, that's the guy from the Hyatt. That's the guy from a couple of weeks ago that nobody introduced me to, and that was Kurt.
Was he singing lyrics, or was it a wordless performance?
Can you remember? He sang. I remember, unbeknownst to us in the band, he and Ed had discussed what he was going to sing. Okay. So I can't remember what he sang. Mm.
He wasn't scatting.
Well, no, but he did some of that, too. Yeah. I will tell you that the thing that I remember from not long after that, he started coming to the Mill just about every Monday night. To his credit, only sat in maybe one every five or so. He was there to listen and to really check out the music. He liked what the band was doing. It was exciting to him. But one of the times that he sat in, there's a Mingus tune called Sue's Changes, and it goes through all of these different sections, different tempos. So when the improvisation happens, each solo occurs over this succession of different tempos and different feels. What we call one chorus is a passage through all these sort of varying landscapes, including one where the soloist sort of just goes off by themselves and the band waits to come back in. And so the band had been playing this tune, and Kurt came up, and when he had his turn to take a chorus, he started singing this story. And it was about some young woman, and somewhat mysterious. I can't remember what it was, but the punchline at the end was that this Sue that he was talking about was a little baby, and Sue's changes were the change of diapers. And I will tell you that when he got to the end of that, there was not a dry eye in the house, especially the women, including the young women that worked there, were all just tears coming down their cheeks, and he completely had them gone. It was really amazing. Mm-hmm.
Kurt was then signed to Blue Note, isn't that right? You were his musical director, is that right?
Yeah. Musical director, co-producer, arranger.
Best part of 20 years.
Yeah.
What would you consider the high point of the recording career with Kurt?
For me personally?
Yeah.
Well, it's a tie. Mm-hmm. Kurt's fifth record for Blue Note was a record called Flirting with Twilight. And on that record, I did a bunch of arrangements for what we think of as sextet configuration, piano, bass, drums, tenor and alto saxophones and trumpet. Of course, it was really a septet because we also had Kurt singing, so that's seven. That was an immensely gratifying project. It was the most highbrow that we had gotten at that point. We recorded in Capitol Studio A in the famous Round building in L.A. with an engineer named Al Schmidt, who is one of the gods still of the engineering world. I think he's one of the people that's won the most Grammys of anybody in history or something like that. He's got over 20 or something like that. And Peter Erskine was playing drums and Mark Johnson was playing the bass. Mm-hmm. And the arrangements flowed amazingly. I will tell you, as a brief aside, I'm now learning one of the digital computer notation programs, but I've done everything by hand, always. And what that means is that when I went into this session, it was the most serious arranging that I'd ever done. And until we started playing, I'd never heard any of this stuff except what was in my head. Mm. And, you know, there was some feeling of if not pressure, at least the gravity of the situation. I mean, we were where we were, recording for Blue Note with some pretty big names, and if the stuff that I'd written wasn't good...
But you rose to the challenge.
I think it's fair to say that I was very, very satisfied with that. And I got my first Grammy nomination for one of those arrangements. Right. The tie would be the record that won the Grammy was recorded live at Lincoln Center, the Dedicated to You record, where I did a lot of string quartet and rhythm section arranging, and that was a live performance that we only had one shot, so there was a little bit of pressure on.
How long was the set?
Between 60 and 75 minutes.
There wasn't much room to maneuver.
No room for error.
You're now living in New York, aren't you? Why did you move to New York?
Well, after we started playing in New York, I knew that I wanted to spend some years of my life living there. Mm-hmm. And we were chatting a little bit about how we have something in common in that because of the trajectory of our domestic lives. Yes. I didn't live very long where I was born and then lived in a bunch of different places. So I sort of don't really feel like I'm from anywhere. And then when you've traveled as much as I have for the last 20 years, you just feel like, I'd kind of like to live here for a while, and I'd like to live there for a while, and I'd like to live over here for a while if I could. And I very much felt that about New York. I just wanted to spend some years living there.
How long are you there now?
7 years now.
Right. And still enjoying it.
Still enjoying it.
How's the jazz scene there?
Oh, the jazz scene in New York is amazing. Mm. It's too amazing. Okay. There's just too much, and there's the number of great players, some of these young guys just in their early 20s, and it's just amazing what they've been able to soak up and crank out. A lot of them are still searching for any kind of real identity, but that's as it should be, you know? You're not supposed to really know who you are yet when you're 21.
Off the top of your head, a couple of good piano players you've seen?
Well, I like Taylor Eixte a lot. Mm-hmm. He's a great young guy. And Emmett Cohen, who's from Florida, and he's a cousin of Anat Cohen, I believe.
Yeah. And you get to Europe quite often, do you, Lawrence?
Have gotten to Europe a lot.
And what do you think of the European jazz scene?
Well, you know, I think it's really fascinating the way that I've heard it mature and improve and get more interesting just over the time that I've been coming here. Obviously, there's been a vital jazz scene in Europe for a long time, but I feel that the successful and indeed deeply interesting exploration of the various groove consciousness choices has really expanded. I've heard some really amazing playing. And then the other phenomenon in Europe, of course, is the audience. Mm. I've long thought that there was a very clear cultural difference and advantage, which is that especially true of younger people, but not exclusively younger people. In Europe, people have their favorite cultural outlets, their favorite type of music or whatever, but there's not this closed-mindedness to checking out other things. So you might, I wouldn't be surprised at all over here to hear a 21-year-old who's into techno dance, rap, hip-hop music or whatever, say, there's a jazz band playing? And you say they're supposed to be really good? Oh, sure. All right, let's go check that out. And that's something that unfortunately doesn't...
Why do you suppose that is?
Well... A lot of it has to do with the embedded nature of culture, you know, the tradition of classical music and the ballet and theater and obviously visual art. It's just much deeper in an older society.
So, Lawrence, your most recent release is what?
It's called Christmas.
And is it self-explanatory?
I like to think so.
Yeah. Tell me more about it.
Well, I've always wanted to make a Christmas record, which is a little funny because a lot of artists feel that they must, but they dread doing so. Mm-hmm. We had a very beautiful Christmas tradition in my family, and growing up with the arts ever present as I did, music was a huge part of that. Mm-hmm. And so I have very fond memories of especially, and that's really what's on the record. The yeah. closest on the record there is to a treatment of a commercial, what you'd call a latter-day commercial tune, is Silver Bells. But it's mostly things like Oh Holy Night and Coventry Carol. And
it's carols.
And it's carols, yeah.
Is it just you or are there other musicians?
Well, it's just me on most of it. Kurt mm-hmm. is singing on two songs, including a new original song that I wrote the lyrics to as well, called Song of the Christmas Bells. I'm very, very pleased with that. And then there are four or five tracks where I am, as I describe it, self-duetting. Sort of like the Bill Evans Conversations exactly. records, piano and electric piano, tracked separately.
Conversations yes. with yourself.
Conversations exactly. with myself, yeah.
Future plans, Lawrence?
Well, I'm really into the quintet, and so I'm really pushing to try to get that out there. The other project I have that I'm very, very excited about is I was lucky enough a couple of years ago to be introduced by a gentleman named Richard Connolly, who's my co-producer on the Christmas record, to a poet named Robert Pinsky, the only three-time poet laureate in U.S. history. And he is an amazing, down-to-earth, unpretentious, wonderful guy. We made one record, and we have a second one in the can. It hasn't been released yet, but it's just him reading and me playing. And in some of the live performances that we've done and are scheduled to do coming up, we've added saxophone and sometimes saxophone and bass. It's pure improvisation in support of reading that is not just textually contextual in terms of the meaning of the poem, but Robert has a way of reading that's very musical, very okay. rhythmic.
Would you have seen the poems before?
Oh, I've studied. Yeah, I studied yeah. his poetry very, very
so
deeply
you're familiar with the poetry.
Before we started interacting.
But you are then responding to his voice as well.
Yes, exactly, okay. exactly.
Okay. And the title of the album?
Poem Jazz.
Poem Jazz. Okay, we shall look out for that one.
Yes, we'll make sure you get some.
Where would we get more information about you?
I have a new website mm-hmm. that is going to be fully opened up very soon.
Okay.
Called. It's just lawrencehopgood.com, mm-hmm. And that should have quite a bit.
Okay, and in the meantime, the record company, we should...
Circumstantial.
Circumstantial.
Circumstantial.us.
Lawrence, really nice talking to you.
Thank you, Ian.
All the best in your future
Thank
career.
You very much.